This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Live Web Radio Report going out to the entire world, and as Bob Whitaker always says, as clear as a bell to the entire world. Good to be with you, and we have a lot to talk about tonight, and I want to share with you some personal observations and some data, which I think is very important for you to understand. A government in the United States of America is completely and totally out of control. As you know, we've spent almost $300 billion in Iraq defending us from the non-existent weapons of mass destruction, causing the world to hate us, causing 1,000 terrorists to come on the scene that wants to kill Americans and hurt Americans for maybe every one that existed before this insane war. We have a war that is maiming and are killing, are wounding, disfiguring, blinding, crippling of literally tens of thousands of Americans, destroying many families, destroying the economic viability of many of those families because of these long separations. Men sign up in the National Guard to defend America from an imminent threat such as invasion, or maybe a little bit of active duty in times like Hurricane Katrina that struck New Orleans. But the National Guard wasn't available in New Orleans because it was over in Iraq, again, fighting not a war for America, but a war for Israel. No American interests were at stake or are at stake in this war. We certainly didn't fight this war for oil. This war has caused an increase in oil prices, a disruption of the oil supply, and we could have bought the oil cheaper, much cheaper, from Saddam Hussein. In fact, he specifically made overtures that he would sell his oil far cheaper than the world market, even at the time, if we would try to repair relations with him. Obviously, he had destroyed the weapons of mass destruction. So it wasn't about oil. It really wasn't about weapons of mass destruction. That was the cover, ladies and gentlemen. It was about Israel. It was about Israel's securing the realm, as Douglas Feith and Richard Pearl wrote, and Mr. Wormser, in fact, I think also, for the British government. Securing the realm was securing the Israeli realm. They wrote this report for Israel 10 years ago, and now they're in key positions of power and influence over the American government in fighting this war. Well, this war has not only cost us $300 billion, but it really probably has cost us a great deal of the $60 billion of loss from the Hurricane Katrina. The first thing I can point out is that the levee system, which the authorities said we needed $52 million for, a tiny drop in the bucket, really, on federal money, was not adequately supplied. In fact, $10 million instead of $50 million, and that $50 million certainly would have secured the main levees, which broke and destroyed so many of the houses and so much of the city of New Orleans. Also, the National Guard would have been on hand to deal with this crisis. But I want to talk about something which is kind of far deeper, and it's symptomatic of where our country is and how the government of our country is so out of touch with the people and the interests of the United States of America. Now, let me tell you about how I came about upon this information and the relationship that I have with this piece of information, because I'm going to tell you something I think is going to shock the bejesus out of you. That's the right word. I don't know what the right word is, but it's going to shock the heck out of you when I tell you these facts. Now, few people in America are aware that Louisiana has the greatest share of wetlands in the United States. The Mississippi Delta, which is almost entirely in Louisiana, is the mother lode of flora and fauna, and there's no area on Earth that produces more life per capita than these precious marshes. You know, the delta of Mississippi directly and the diverted part of the Mississippi, the Chafalaya, and all of South Louisiana. Do you know it's one of the most important, probably the biggest fish estuary in the world? In fact, Louisiana has by far the largest seafood industry in the United States of America. Now, you can think about all the deep sea fishing and the ocean fishing that goes on in the Northeast, cod fishing, lobster, and so forth. Louisiana has it by far, and yet it's a very small part of the American coast. That's because of the tremendous wealth of flora and fauna, and the fish gain there. They breed there. They gain a lot of their food and sustenance in these waters. And we're talking about saltwater fish and brackish fish. We're not just talking about freshwater, but we're talking about the fish that live in the Gulf of Mexico, shrimp, crabs, and many other kinds of seafood that thrive here. Now, I know about the wetlands intimately because as a young boy, these areas were my greatest joy. I didn't live among many mountains. When I was very young in Holland, my father and mother and my sister and I would take many trips throughout Europe, and I can still faintly remember as a very, very young man hiking in the Alps. And I think I developed a love for the mountains then that I still carry today. In fact, that is my favorite kind of topography in the world, is being in the mountains and climbing the peaks. But as a young boy, I loved woodsmanship and I loved nature. And luckily, just a few miles from where I lived in the city of New Orleans was one of the wildest and purest and pristine parts of nature in the world, and that's what was what we called New Orleans East. It was absolute swamp, occasional trees, lots of water, both fresh, brackish, and salt, tremendous amounts of wildlife, everything from wild boars to alligators to rabbits to every kind of poisonous snake you can imagine that exists in the United States, coral snakes, diamondback rattlers, different kinds of rattlesnakes, cottonmouth moccasins. It was a young man's dream because I just loved it. Squirrels, every kind of life that you could possibly think of. And I learned back there in those swamps a lot about nature, and I learned to appreciate it. And as a young boy, I write about this quite in depth in my awakening, and it was quite amazing. When you're that age, you don't even worry about the mosquito bites and some of the hardship of being out there, but you just begin to develop this incredible love for your surroundings. In fact, I can tell you that the Louisiana swamps and wetlands are discussed with such passion in my book, My Awakening, because it was really spawned by a great love. And it's my belief that my political and social ideology and point of view grew from that love of nature and inculcated from South Louisiana. And I think the inclinations and understandings of the natural world led me to see that our people and their unique expression of humanity is part of that wonderful natural world, and it's worthy of preservation. In fact, one of my early books that had an effect on me was Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. And it was a very short jump for me, especially being a Southerner and being in the South when I came of age, a lot of the civil rights conflict came about. And it was a very quick, short jump for me to understand that if we should be concerned about the wildlife, which was driven to extinction, and the fact that we want to preserve every kind of different natural life on Earth, such as the African elephant or the Rocky Mountain cougar or the great blue whale of the Pacific or the snail darter. It was a short jump, a short leap to understand that the beautiful creations of nature in terms of our own people, that this also was valuable. Now, over the years, I've paid close attention to the ecological issues facing South Louisiana. Obviously, it's a place I grew up in, it's a place I've loved, and it's a place I have a lot of concern for. And I can tell you something else, that over the years I've followed certain things, and I remember that a couple of years ago, It was in 2004, and I was reading about this. I remember when I was reading about it, and I remember my specific circumstances. I was reading a newspaper about it, and there was a big controversy. At that time, George Bush was in the election for President of the United States, during this time, now this is really amazing. Then we can start getting some data here that I think is going to really be amazing for you. At the same time, he was proposing that Iraq restore the marshes that existed. You know, he talked about the old vision of restoring the garden, you know, the biblical garden of Eden. You know, the Iraqi marshes and swamps, and that he proposed. Now, this is an absolute fact, ladies and gentlemen, without any question about this at all. He proposed that $100 million be proposed to restore the Iraqi marshes. Now, Louisiana, part of the United States of America, has been suffering marsh and wetland erosion at an incredibly fast pace. I think the actual fact is that we lose it's just amazing. I'm just trying to think. I think it's somewhere around 24 square miles a year. I mean, that's a lot of land, ladies and gentlemen. This has been going on since the 1930s. A lot of this came about through the over-harvesting of the great cypress trees and some of the swamps, the building of canals which serviced a lot of the oil industry and the rigs. When you built these canals, and it seeped in more of the saline and salt water, which destroyed those canals. So we've been having a real serious problem with the receding marshes in South Louisiana. Now, the interesting aspect of this, and I didn't put it together at the time, I didn't think much about the hurricane problem, but the interesting aspect of all this is that the marshes, you see, are a natural protection from hurricanes. I read somewhere that it's estimated that that for every mile of wetlands, every mile of wetland, just 1 mile of wetland, a hurricane storm surge is reduced by about 6 inches, about a half a foot, for every single mile of wetland. Well, we've lost hundreds and hundreds of miles of wetlands. The land that and marshes that served as a protection for New Orleans from hurricanes for generations. And we had a terrible hurricane that came and hit New Orleans with Betsy in 1963, and it didn't do anywhere near the damage of this hurricane. One reason for that was the fact that the city was protected by far more wetlands that would buffer and protect the city from hurricanes than we currently have. So I want to get this to you, a real visual, or not visual, I guess, but I guess, yeah, visual. So just picture a chart here, and picture George Bush proposing to Congress that we spend $100 billion, restoring the wetlands, and $100 million to restore the Iraqi marshlands. At the same time, he proposed a whopping $7 million to restore the Louisiana wetlands. The wetlands, of course, again, which is a source of so much of our seafood industry, it's important to our economy, it's important to Americans who live here, it's been important to our protection. Now, you see, that is government totally out of control. I'm reminded during a campaign stop that I made in my last race for governor, and I stopped at a small, I think it was a Holiday Inn, and there was a nice lady behind the desk, and we started talking, and she said, Representative Duke, I just have a question for you. She said, look, I'm a single mother, my husband's dead, and I barely make my taxes. I mean, I can barely afford to put food on the table for myself and my child. Being a desk clerk at a Holiday Inn, even though I have an education, I have a college degree, is just not bringing me very much income to support myself and my baby. And she said, I just got this thing in the mail, and it was about talking about how the fact that the United States was going to spend whatever godly amount, I can't remember the number at this time, but it was somewhere, I think, around $50 million, $100 million. And she said to me, she said, Representative, she said, how can it be? How can the government make me pay taxes? Again, I'm somebody who's just barely surviving, and the taxes is one thing that hurts me in terms of my ability to pay my bills. Make me pay taxes, threatens to put me in jail if I don't pay the taxes, so forcibly takes my money and then sends my money overseas to people who've never paid a penny in tax. She said, how can that be? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense at all. Hell, I need help. How can the government force me? Now, she said, I don't mind giving to charity. I give in my church. I tithe in my church. My church does many charities. And sometimes I tithe with, I give some money to United Way. Here when we have the United Way drive. I told her, by the way, that United Way was not the best way to go, because United Way also supports the NAACP. I said, just go to individual charities that you want to support. She said, and I can understand if people want to give away money or give charity around the world, that's certainly their right. But how does the government have the right to forcibly take your money and decide where your money is going to go in charity in other parts of the world? Maybe I can see it in America. People get together, you know, in the little towns of Louisiana or Mississippi or Montana. The farm burned down and the community would help them build. And when we have a terrible storm or attack, certainly. But there's something wrong with this. And there's something wrong with the President of the United States when he says that we're going to spend $100 million and wants to allocate that to restore the destroyed marshlands of Iraq, and wants to spend $7 million to restore the marshlands of Louisiana, where Americans live, which is vital to our economy as well as vital to our ecological health and beauty and wonder of this part of the world. And now, I'm not saying that this money could have saved New Orleans, obviously. I doubt that that money could have. But over the years, if our government would have been paying attention to our marshlands, the serious, most serious problems of New Orleans probably would not have occurred. It was a monster storm. It was a terrible storm. And I, by the way, I believe that that is part of global warming. I am one of these people that believe in global warming. I've seen the satellite pictures of the retreating, of the vastly retreating Arctic areas of the Earth, and in warmer waters. In fact, it's always been known since watching hurricanes as a very young boy, and always reading about them now for all my life, because it was a fact of life where I lived. You always knew that the hurricane would be worse if it was hotter. If the water was warmer, more energy was generated. That's why the hurricanes kind of peter out when they get more northern in the Atlantic Ocean, because the water gets so warm. That's why the hurricane that struck, I think, the Carolina coast was a very minor hurricane, because of the fact that the water is much cooler in that area of the earth. So if warming takes place, you should have more and more frequent storms, and you have the possibility of having storms that are bigger. Now, there's no proof that these storms right now are the storms don't offer any proof of global warming, because there always can be changes. There can be flukes in terms of a mythological or proportionate Anyway, there's no proof that these more frequent storms, more powerful storms, are proof of global warming. But I do believe, from some of the other evidence, that the global warming is having an effect here. Now, we do know that, again, that the money the Corps of Engineers in the city of New Orleans and the parish of Jefferson offered and wanted to protect our levees, they said $52 million we needed, and the administration only gave $11 million. Well, of course, we've got our money being spent over in Iraq. Even more tragic, of course, the looting. And by the way, I don't blame the looting on the government. I don't blame the fact that there were people shooting at firemen and policemen and rescuers and helicopters, you know, on the government. I blame that on the African Americans who were doing that. And it's unfortunate that such a high percentage of African Americans engaged in this kind of absolutely insane, improper, savage type of behavior. And we know for a fact that many whites in the city of New Orleans were targeted by black predators for being white. I can quote from 24 different sources, major sources from media around the United States and the world, quoting groups of whites who said specifically that they were met for days with racial abuse and threats and attacks, that they kind of had to circle the wagons, like the wagon trains in the old West, even in a facility like the Superdome, which had police and other authorities on hand. Ladies and gentlemen, it was an improper, it was an incredible display. But the government should be blamed for not realizing this was capable. I mean, I've been saying this is capable among some of these elements. Hell, New Orleans is not all that safe even when there's no storm. New Orleans has a murder rate that's incredible. You know, New Orleans has the same kind of murder rate as Moscow. It's got 400,000 people in New Orleans. And Moscow has 13 million, and yet they got the same murder rate in New Orleans as Moscow. And by the way, Moscow is a lot poorer. I mean, the average salary in this city is probably $200 or $300 a month. And there's a lot of unemployment, a lot of suffering, a lot of homelessness, and no real welfare system. They do have the medical care that you can receive, and they have certain kinds of assistance that way, but there's no real welfare system provided by the government to the people. So and yet their crime rate is lower. Actually, I feel much safer in the streets of Moscow than I do when I walk on some of the streets of New Orleans. And that's not all the areas of New Orleans. Where my old family home is, in the lakefront, it's pretty safe. You know, however, unfortunately, up by the lake, it used to be that the African Americans in New Orleans would go along the very eastern part of the beach, more closer to their neighborhoods. And in the past 5 or 6 years, they've now taken over the entire lakefront. The green grassy areas on the New Orleans side of the lake, not the Mandeville side, which is almost all European Americans still, and to the point where white families don't even want to go out there to barbecue or bring their kids because of the conditions that exist. It's a similar condition, not quite as exacerbated as during the hurricane, but a very similar to the condition to that that took place after the hurricane. That's the kind of thing that goes on. And that's the kind of thing that's been repeated all over the country. I know I'm going to be called a hater and a bigot and every other name in the book simply for talking about these facts, that a lot of white people can't use their public parks or facilities because of the racial hatred, animosity, abuse that's hurled upon them, the danger of black crime. And you can blame it for what, you know, it's like they always say, you know, let's just take white kids in black schools. Now, you can argue that black crime comes because they're poorer. However, that's not a really as good argument, because the truth is more poor in America are white than black, believe it or not. A higher percentage among poor are black, but more poor in this country, in America, are white than black. And yet blacks are still committing a vast majority of the violent crime in the United States of America. And the likelihood is, even though 2/3 of the poor are white in terms of numbers, the likelihood is that if a white person has an armed robbery against them or a non-familial rape, somebody on the street, it's almost, you know, always a non-white doing the robbing or raping or attacking or whatever. That's just a reality of life. And the fact that I would oppose this and feel that this was wrong, again, I will be called a racist or a bigot or a hater. But if someone, you know, justifiably denounces a white person who kills a black child or a black person or the dragging death of James Byrd, if that takes place, well, that person is just, that's great, you know, this exposing this injustice. But if a white person faces injustice, you know, then it's a federal case, ladies and gentlemen. Then you have real hatred going on here. So that, you know, we've got such a twisted distorted world that we live in, and it's a distorted world in many ways, and a distorted perception because of the fact that the media is controlled. I'll give an example. I got a letter today, and of course I talk a lot about the Jewish question, and I, you know, it's so important to point out when people, a lot of people who have encountered some of the racial problems, such as in New Orleans and elsewhere, they say, well, the racial problem is obvious because they've experienced it with their kids in the school. They've experienced it with the affirmative action in the job. They've experienced it in the things they've seen. But they say, why are you against, quote, the Jewish race? Well, I'm not against the Jewish race, but I'm against the Jewish extremists that dominate the Jewish race and dominate us, and that too many Jews go along with, and the Jews acquiesce to, and they support their leaders. But their leaders are certainly extreme, and they have brought about the changes in this country. They have been the driving force behind immigration. The change of America from a 90% European-American society to one that's probably less than 70% today and maybe less than 50% by the middle of the century, which is a blink of an eye historically. It's an incredible socio and cultural and racial change that the country is going through. The driving force behind this has been Jewish supremacists. The same Jews, in fact, many of the same Jews that supported the foundation of the all-Jewish Israeli state, such as Emma Lazarus, who we always used to call her Enema Lazarus in our younger days, who supported the whose scratchings about America, give us the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. I don't think America was the wretched refuse. I think America was created by far-sighted individuals who had to scrape together a lot of money to come to this to this country, had to work hard to save, to pay for the passage, underwent incredible hardships in that passage to the New World, and then incredible hardships, danger, disease, and everything else in building a new life in America. That's not the wretched refuse to me. That's some of the best people and some of the most vigorous and intelligent and far-sighted people that a society can offer. It is true that you had some prison colonies, for instance, in parts of a very small part of the South. In Australia, you did. But that, you know, but those that try to characterize America as populated by those people are whistling Dixie. I mean, they're not, if that's the word, they're not really telling the truth, because that was a tiny percentage of the people who came. Most people came here. In fact, some people were even willing to sell themselves into indentured servitude or slavery for a while, just for the opportunity to come to this country and take part in the building of this country. That's an amazing sacrifice. And they weren't indentured servants in Britain, but they were willing to do that, to come to this country and start a new life for themselves and their family. And by the way, indentured servants were quite often treated far worse than any under black people under slavery. And the reason why is because the owner of an indentured servant or a slave for a while, whether it be 5 years or 7 years or 11 years or whatever it was, knew that it was a very short time frame, that they tried to get as much work out of them for this short period of time. Whereas the slaves that came from Africa, the black slaves, they had, so to speak, a very heavy and expensive investment in them, and they had to, you know, it was in their interest to keep them healthy and fit and relatively happy, satisfied with decent shelter and decent diet and decent life. And many of the blacks that came over, in fact, were, you know, encouraged to set up, you know, their churches and ministers and the whole bit. They had a whole framework of welfare set up for them. The indentured servants, however, were just often worked to death because of the fact they'd be here so shortly. So anyway, this lady writes, this is Debbie, and she says, I totally agree with you about the black situation in New Orleans. It's a terrible thing, what is going on there. However, I can't understand your views against the Jewish race. I do agree with you about the blacks. Something must be done. Our public schools are in shambles because of this. And in the news today and in every day since the hurricane hit New Orleans, this has stood out with me. I really can't understand why the American public can't see that it is the blacks in New Orleans that are doing the damage, looting, shooting. Now, as the government is shipping these same people who are doing the looting, shooting, and killing to other cities and towns across our great nation, and things are beginning to happen from that issue. There are also rapes, break-ins, fights in school. The list goes on and on. America needs to wake up to this. The welfare of blacks is a good picture of people that have had everything given to them and expecting everything for free. And he starts, and this person is apparently a farmer. He's in the north. I live in Michigan. He says, she says, I've had two black men come to my homestead in the last couple of days wanting milk or goats. We raise dairy goats and milk them. And an older man was rather rude. I explained that we're not milking now, as all the goats are due to kid. And he has the nerve to tell me I would sell them goats and milk after they have their babies. I said, no, I won't. What part of that don't you understand? I told him to go to a farm auction and buy some. But does he live in a farm where he can care for him? He said, no, he lives in town. I led him to the gate and then told him to leave. He came through at the gate near the lane and came on our private land. To call the police is in vain in these matters. I live in Michigan, and the black man is always right. And that's from Debbie, and writing from Michigan. Well, that's kind of an interesting notation. That's, again, from Michigan. So there you go. But Debbie, the situation is that you I think you'll understand this as you go along. The entire genesis of the black-white problem in this country has had direct involvement in Jewish presence. You probably don't even realize this. Most of the slave traders who brought the blacks to America were in fact Jewish. Jews had a much higher slave ownership than whites in the United States on a per capita basis. And I'm talking about this from studies I've made of Jewish books. You can find this on my website and find this to be very interesting. And of course, once they came here to this country, they had a very, very prominent role in the so-called civil rights movement, which was really spawned by communists, mainly Jewish communists, like those who started the NAACP, who were almost all members of the Communist Party and other communist organizations. And that may sound wild and crazy, but it's true. And there was only one black person even associated with the original NAACP, which worked for the forced integration of our society, not for black nationalism, like men like Marcus Garvey, who I have great respect for, even Malcolm X, and to an extent I had respect for, in the sense that he wanted to be self-reliant among the black people. Louis Farrakhan's that way. He wants his own society. He doesn't want integration. He doesn't want intermarriage between whites and blacks. He simply wants blacks to run their communities and whites to have the right to run our own communities. Certainly some of the things he says about us I don't like, but I can respect a man who wants to defend his own heritage and his own way of life. And then you can take a look at the egalitarian propaganda, you know, the whole idea that there's no racial difference at all, which is really such a preposterous idea that it's just the color of skin. It's easily shown that there's immense psychological and even physiological differences between whites and blacks. We are different. That's not trying to say one is superior and inferior. When you talk about those subjects, you got to say in what regard, you know. But there are vast differences between whites and blacks, and there's differences in culture between us. There's differences in psychologies between us, and yet this whole egalitarian theory was done by Franz Boas, who was a Jewish immigrant from Germany, and most of the students were in fact also Jews, and the leaders of so-called egalitarianism in this country have also been Jews, such as Cameron, Rose, the late Dr. Gould, and so many others. Then we can go on. We can go to the so-called civil rights movement, which I argue wasn't really a civil rights, but a civil wrongs movement. It really led to the destruction of more human rights than it provided. It changed a relatively peaceful area of the country, the South, and many other cities in the United States, into one of racial hostility and almost warfare. It led to massive increases in crime. It led to masses of black men becoming hooked on drugs. It led to masses of black men and people going to jail which is probably even worse than any form of slavery that existed in the past. It has denied the civil rights of millions of white people in jobs, scholarships, in college admissions, who are better qualified for those jobs. It has destroyed countless neighborhoods. It has destroyed incredible numbers of schools. It has subjected millions of white children into an environment that's absolutely intolerable. Again, I can always talk about the differences between the so-called civil rights movement and what real civil rights are, because the civil rights movement was basically the idea that it's in a terrible that blacks go to their own schools or have their own entrances in a theater or a restaurant or have a separate water fountain. And I always used to say, how do you compare that with literally tens of thousands of whites who have died as a result of black crime? Because I believe the civil rights movement let go certain social structures which led to white people facing a great deal of victimization at the hands of black criminals. So we can talk about that subject a lot too, but I'm going to let's go on and see what else we have on the board. Let's go to stormfront.org and see if we have any questions or posts at this time. And again, you can post on Stormfront Town Hall. That's stormfront.org, and that's available to you. And this is interactive radio, so you can post your own ideas and talk about what goes on here. All right, here we have one from Free Zundel Now. He says, Bushstein and all the rest of the Zionist puppets we have going back to Harry Truman, they're all guilty. They should all be locked up for having funded Zionist interests at the expense of American interests. Losing our most important port city has made this as clear as day. And this is a quotation, James Buchanan. He says, the Bush administration has requested $62 billion so far in emergency funds for damage done by Hurricane Katrina. While it's inevitable that a strong hurricane will cause a few billion in wind damage, the most expensive disaster, the flooding of New Orleans, was entirely avoidable. The levee failures that drowned the city of New Orleans have George Bush's fingerprints all over them. The president bears the full responsibility for flood control in America, not the local governor or the mayor. Of course he does, because it goes through the Corps of Engineers. And one federal website notes, Flood Control Act of 1936 gave the Army Engineer Corps the mission to provide flood protection to the entire country. Flood control is clearly responsibility of the federal government. The need to improve New Orleans levees was recognized in 1995, and hundreds of millions of dollars of levee repairs were done until George Bush defunded this effort. One news article notes, when flooding from a massive rainstorm in May 1995 killed 6 people, Congress authorized the Southeast Louisiana Urban Flood Control Project, or SELA, over the next 10 years. The Army Corps of Engineers, tasked with carrying out SELA, spent $430 million on shoring up levees and building pumping stations, with $50 million in local aid. But at least $250 million in crucial projects remained, even as hurricane activity in the Atlantic Basin increased dramatically and levees surrounding New Orleans continued to subside. Yet after 2003, the flow of federal dollars toward SELA dropped to a trickle. The Corps never tried to hide the fact that spending pressures of the war in Iraq, caused this problem. Anyway, so that's pretty interesting, and it's so true. And this is Dave Cooper, and he's talking about how such a powerful thing we have in terms of CDs. And you can take this show, for instance, and burn it, put it on a CD, and distribute it anywhere in the world. And also, we're going to be going certainly into videos and that type of data and information for people. And that's the kind of information which can have a huge impact on people's attitudes and ideas. We need to have ways to present our issues as effectively and intelligently and as powerfully as possible. And the way to do that really is through audio and visual, because that's the kind of world we live in. People, and whether it's good or bad, people are much more likely to watch a movie than they are to read a book. I am glad that so many people have read my books, My Awakening and Jewish Supremacism, but we need more things like that. And I one of my many projects, among many others that I have to do, is to put out an audio version of My Awakening and Jewish Supremacism. So that's one more thing I have on the burner, if I can get by with my teaching, my traveling, my speaking, my organizing, my publications, my websites, my articles, and taking care of other business, if I can do that, I'll hopefully work some more on those projects. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've already been on the air longer than we are basically our time allotted, because nowadays we do about a half an hour normally in the show, but it's been about an hour every day with the crisis in New Orleans. I look forward to being with you tomorrow, and until then, all I can tell you is God bless you, take care of yourself, and please take some time and make some effort to spread this program around the web. Now, you have the opportunity to do that, so do it, ladies and gentlemen. Get it out there. Just get it out. Go to these websites. Make some posts. You can even say, even racist David Duke talked about that. I don't care what you say. And then put the link. And there are ways to get this message out if you just simply work on doing it. This is David Duke. I guess this is Dr. David Duke now speaking to you. I'm not quite as famous as Dr. Phil yet, but we're working on it. And I do hope that you'll really work hard in getting our ideas and issues and getting my website, davidduke.com, and also stormfront.org, to many thousands of new people. You have the weapon right by you, the most powerful weapon in the world, the powerful weapon that can change the minds of millions of men and women. It's right at your fingertips. It's the World Wide Web, and it's your computer. So please use it, and let's get this information out, and let's together change the world. Thanks a lot, and I'll see you tomorrow night. Bye-bye.
This has been David Duke for our heritage and our freedom.